guy is really not kind
of
like.
Yeah, but before Chavez. That, there was something else I was thinking of. That's a very important point of any of this discussion is that whatever this guy, whatever AMLO and his party and the movement around him promises, unless they're going to, you know, try to mobilize people against the system, create, you know, popular assemblies or councils or Soviets or whatever you want to call it, unless you're going to start, you know, infiltrating the armed forces in a serious way and having training people in self-defense against the army and so on, you're going to run into what you just said, Diego. You're going to run into the Chavez dilemma and the dilemma of every social democrat that claims to be a socialist since the Social Democratic Party existed in Europe in a big way. The German Social Democratic Party around World War I, for example. If you don't see...
They were the ones that voted for the war.
Yeah, and killed Luxembourg and Liebknecht.
Kotsky, that's where Lenin and Kotsky had a split.
Yep, huge. And so, yeah, if you don't see that capitalism will come back to destroy and more, do more than even destroy the reforms that you have won at a time of when the movement was strong, when the left was strong, then you don't see the nature of capitalism, you know, and they're going to take those reforms back and some. And so that, so for example, there's so many examples, but let's say Chile, 1973, socialist, a Marxist, actually, Allende, open Marxist, open socialist, running in a, what was it, Socialist Party, I think it was called, gets elected.
Yep.
It was a socialist party. I think it was actually called the Socialist Party.
Of many, not just one.
Well, I think his was called the Socialist Party, but I have to double check that. Anyway, so he gets elected, and they nationalized the copper industry, which is one of the main industries in Chile. That's great. What about the others? Because economic power turns into political power, turns into military power, right? And so the capitalists see this industry that they used to make profits off of nationalized. Capitalists here in the United States, by the way, as well.
Like AT&T.
And they get mad. They get really upset.
AT&T were the first. Well, actually, they were the ones that went to Congress and said, we need to, you know, business as usual. This is to defend our investments.
So they have a coup that overthrows a military coup that sets up a military dictatorship for the next, however many years or decades, that overthrows Allende, the popularly elected socialist Marxist government there. But the process in which they did that was not just pure brute force. It was economic destabilization as well, like you're seeing in Venezuela now, like you're seeing, you can see in any country, like you'll see in Mexico. Chile, a relatively rich country by South American standards, but still not by capitalist standards internationally. So the destabilization created food shortages and so on. They infiltrated the truck drivers union with CIA plants and CIA supporters, conservatives. They disrupted transportation. So what I'm trying to say is that the capitalists don't just sit back and say, yeah, go ahead and make those reforms. They're just counting the days till they have the strength. And counting the days is too passive. They are organizing in their own way a counter-revolution. Or counter-reformism. You know, there's always counter-reformism or counter-revolution under any attempts to change capitalism. And if the left isn't clear on what that means, the socialists, whatever they're called, that get into power, meaning you can't stop at the reforms. You got to go all the way. And to go all the way, you got to mobilize the people for a revolution, for social revolution. And unless you are serious about that, you're just biding your time. And some people would defend that, say, oh, well, you know, the perfect is the enemy of the good and all that kind of crap. Well, the problem with that scenario is Trump, Pinochet. Now, Trump's not a fascist, but the problem is that things keep changing, right? So you might be satisfied for a year or two because you're maybe upper middle class or something, but the poor and the working class keep getting ground down into the dirt, into the mud. And things change, and they don't always change progressive. There's no sort of, things get more, you know, there's no sort of upward straight line from progressive reforms to
right wing.
to more progressive reforms forever, right? Yeah, it can go right wing easily. Using
people. It's like what happened in Germany.
Yeah, using people, yeah. People get their hopes up, and then those hopes are destroyed, and then some, they're set backwards, they don't see a future. They will turn right wing if there's no left alternative. There's no socialist alternative.
Those beer halls that Hitler used to go and, you know, they had speeches. It was all Communist Party people there in the beginning, in the 20s, before he even knew who Hitler was.
Yep.
You know, and then that's where everything, you know, the socialist workers, so-called socialist, national socialist workers, which is the Nazis.
With money from big business and,
IBM and
big business people and corporate, you know, people from the bourgeois helping that along. But the fact is, yeah, they're drawing from dissatisfied, desperate working people.
Yeah, because everybody in that hall that he was, you know, all this dissatisfaction talking about, you know, how many barrels of Marx do you need for a loaf of bread? That's basically what the what was happening in Germany at the time after World War One.
Right, and the largest communist party in the world that could have led a revolution to take over the economy and democratically plan for human needs.
Almost did.
In the early 20s, 23. Yeah. Then if that's not followed through on, then and you're just going to spin your wheels in reformism, then sooner or later that parade's going to, that truck's going to stop. It's going to get stuck in the mud of capitalist inequality, repression, depression, and then counter-revolution or counter-reformism that's quite violent, like in Mexico, for example. And we're going to have to fast forward through this article. It's 11 pages, but basically they talk about the mistakes of the left in that period. They talk about the 60s being a bit of a boom period for some of the, and you have to underline some, like a very minority of the Mexican ruling class. And then so by 68, you had an increase in population, you had urban development, you had public investment in large infrastructure and housing, and you had Mexico ready to host the Olympic Games, right? But this was very unequal. And among the masses of peasants and workers, things were not so rosy, not even close. And they were still being exploited horribly and politically repressed because this was not in the 60s a progressive regime despite the growth. So there were struggles in the 60s out of this desperation, including guerrilla struggles, which we don't have time to really go into. Which the state used, by the way, to scare people, but that was a result of the repression and so on as well. For example, they had these things called, as much as possible, they would try to decapitate political movements from the left. And they did that through official corporatist organizations, quote-unquote, and charras. Charras, mercenary gangs, which is a feature in Mexico to this day. They probably, I don't know the details, but they probably use these drug gangs as part of that in some places, you know.
In
Mexico, I'm talking about Mexico. Yeah, same thing, yeah.
Yeah.
So they got some reforms during the 60s, but by 68, quote, social inequality, by the way, I'm on the fourth page of this article, social inequality had increased considerably. The stabilizing development of the earlier 60s worked like a charm for the 10% of richest families that accounted for half of the national income, but not for the 40% of the poorest who only had 14% of national income. So you see that gap. You had 10% with 50% national income, but 40% spread, 14% spread among 40%. That's just one of many social inequality stats. The social and economic gap also had regional features with a much poorer South than in the North. Now they needed, in this period in the 60s where you had a repressive government but you had growth, they wanted actually more skilled labor. They also wanted to silence social discontent. So the PRI governments allowed children of working families to have more access to higher education, some, you know. So the number of students enrolled in the National Autonomous University of Mexico, UNAM, and in the National Polytechnic Institute, IPN, and in the state universities increased exponentially around that time. Yeah.
That's what my uncle
Which one?
Went.
UPenn?
The one who lives there in Mexico, which I'm going this summer to visit. This one. Nacional Politécnico.
Yeah. So these...
Instituto Nacional.
So universities in Mexico acquired a distinctive feature. They became mass for the first time, but the capitalist labor market was unable to absorb the mass of graduating students. So you had thousands of children of workers and peasants going into classrooms. They get trained professionally and technically, but they also got politicized because of the lack of jobs and because of just the general conditions in Mexico. So they resumed a long tradition of organization and struggle within the universities, especially UNAM, especially teacher training, like where those 43 teachers, teaching students disappeared, were murdered in Mexico. Oh, was it 2 years ago now?
Yeah, which is under investigation
now.
Yeah, investigation.
So this is the material basis, because this is an article written by Marxists. This is the material basis for what's to follow in the big mass movements in Mexico, based a lot in the student movement. So, quote, the youth movement that broke out in Mexico City and throughout the country in 68 and before did not fall like a bolt from the sky. In a way, it was the resurgence of the revolutionary consciousness of an entire people, with the mass organization of the peasants and workers firmly subordinated to the bourgeoisie in the state. The class struggle was expressed through the youth. So, in other words, where the unions and the previously radical parties, workers' parties, which had now become part of the state apparatus, should have been fighting, they weren't. They were long past that period. The unions had been very much repressed, regulated, and turned into like supporting organizations for the PRI. So to the point where independent unions to this day are problematic in Mexico. You know, they get harassed and repressed really badly. When I was in the United Electrical Workers, we were trying to help organize independent or autonomous unions in Mexico. And with mixed success, not big enough success, obviously. The youth that had grown up in the authoritarianism of the regime were educated in the radical and socialist cultures of the university and facing an increasing uncertain future. So there, in a nutshell, is the, you know, one paragraph, a good materialist explanation of what's going on. Now, there's international context of why this happened in 68. Now, there's international context, too, which you alluded to earlier, Diego. The international context was also deeply inspiring for Mexican youth. The Cuban Revolution in 59, the assassination of Che, 1968 in France, in the May 68, they call it, mobilizations against the Vietnam War in the United States, the Latin America guerrilla movement, the Black Panthers in the U.S., the assassination of Martin Luther King, etc. All of these and more were combined with the recent memories of the teacher struggle, the railroad strike of 58 in Mexico, the murder of Ruben Jaramillo. Did you ever hear of him?
In 62? Yes. Okay. Ruben
Jaramillo. Yeah. The movement of the doctors of 65, the protests of UNAM in 66, and many others. So they all came together to light up the Great Explosion of 1968. And that's interesting because what do we know about Mexican history? And one of the reasons we're discussing this is because Mexico is this great unknown, as we started to talk about earlier and didn't finish that thought so much. But here, what are the two countries bordering the U.S.? Obviously, Canada and Mexico, right? Mm-hmm. One of the two countries you don't hear much about in the media, Canada and Mexico. That is not an accident. That is because, for a variety of reasons, because they've always been subordinate to U.S. imperialism to a certain extent, but also because things like the health care program in Canada, don't want the people to know too much about that. In Mexico, you want people to think of them as a threat rather than as people, you know, doing amazing political work and political movements that we should be doing more of here, and as real people fighting for themselves, not victims of some sort or whatever. So anyway, I'm going to have to fast forward through some of this, but basically what happened is the youth started to move. They'd already had some demonstrations. The government used some sort of fight between two schools as an excuse to crack down. Watch out calling the police, basically. Watch out when you call 911, so to speak. This was an example of that. I'm not saying this was the main reason. It's just that what triggered it. There was some sort of brawl between two schools. The police showed up and started to really crack down on people, using that as an excuse. And this just further enraged the movement. So the National Federation of Technical Students kind of reluctantly called for a 26th July protest. Small number of demonstrators coincided with demonstration commemoration of the 1953 assault on the Moncada barracks in Cuba, promoted by different organizations on the left and the Mexican Communist Party. Activists from the left marched along with young people who were attending a demonstration for the first time, who mainly came from where your uncle went to school, the National Polytechnic Institute. To the surprise of many, the march was brutally broken up by the police in the streets at the center of the city. Anyone under the age of 20 who was in the vicinity was persecuted and beaten by the cops, including the young people of the National Autonomous University Preparatory Schools of Mexico, part of UNAM, located in the heart of the city. The official excuse to justify the repression was the habitual one. Young foreign communists, quote-unquote, were trying to organize uprisings with the purpose of getting publicity and destabilizing the country just before the start of the Olympic Games. Police violence inflamed the indignation of the student community and two large universities in the country, EPIN, the Polytechnic Institute, and UNAM, forging a feeling of unity against the common enemy. So it's a combination of this little brawl that they used to jump in, plus the stuff that was happening in the background, the Olympics coming up, the repressive government, PR government, very nervous about that, and the usual anti-communism, anti-social stuff that they were using against the increased radicalization of the students. The reaction against the police had a very important side effect. It provoked a complete rejection by students of the official student organization. By the way, I don't know if I had to read that, but you can imagine the radicalization happening. They got around the official student movement there and made it more radical. More violence against the students, the more radical they got. There was July 31st, a big demonstration, more than 80,000 students took over the center of Mexico City. And August 5th, massive march led by the coordinating committee of the Technical Institute, EPIN, and a strike promoted by students of the Polytechnic took over the historic center of the city. 3 days later, August 8th, 1968, a new step forward when teachers got involved for the first time. They started a national strike committee with representatives from the union, from the student unions, or from the schools. So the movement was growing with the emergence of creativity and organization and some participation of workers for the first time. They had these brigades that traveled around the country getting support for the gathering protests and strikes. And they had a list of demands: stop police violence, punish the responsible higher-ups, dissolution of the Granaderos, specialist armored police units, meaning they were bringing tanks in and stuff, free the political prisoners from the previous days of struggle, government compensation for the families of the dead and injured, repeal of Article 145 of the Criminal Code that articulates the crime of social dissolution, meaning laws against political activity, and recognition of responsibility for acts of repression and vandalism by the authorities, police, Granaderos, and the army. So they did start having assemblies, which is really good, meaning they were creating a place to talk and make decisions. Strikes were continuing. The strike became a school itself, meaning going on strike to transform consciousness quickly, changing the focus of thousands of young people on daily events and their schooling, and raise the horizon, talking about what's happening in the world became normal. Young women who participated massively in the struggle also placed their aspirations at the center of the discussion. Not only did they demand democracy, the women of 68 demanded the right to decide, to have access to contraceptive pills, to manage their own body freely without any external interference. Now, this seems to be a quick jump in the article, but it's actually, if you think about it, women are getting out of the home for the first time in a lot of places in Mexico through this education stuff, through increased jobs and so on. So, quote, young women learn to demand equality and not to renounce it. Machismo and sexist violence, deeply rooted in Mexican society, was actively and consciously combated at this time. Thousands of women participated in the night brigades, spoke at the assemblies, printed pamphlets, painted. They rebelled against the idea of being there only to organize collective food or for cleaning. They showed a great willingness to get rid of the chains of the domestic care in their homes, and they became a fundamental part of the movement's combative vanguard. They became indispensable. Now, that's something you don't hear about 68 much in Mexico. I never read much about
that. Well, my grandfather always encouraged the daughters, his daughters.
He did?
Not to be, he was anti-machista.
Good.
So he encouraged, hey, go and, you know, and learn. And
yeah.
That's when my mother was sent to Cuba. That's why I was born there.
Oh, cool.
Because he felt that at that time, that was the most progressive of what Latin America, what he wanted in Latin America to look like. So he sent my mother, he's like, go to Nicaragua, you know, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's great. At this point, going back to the article, the movement had a clear main objective, democracy. But the democracy the youth demanded with social justice and without repression was incompatible with the Mexican state and the PRI regime. The struggle for democratic liberties became inseparable from a broader struggle to transform society. And the Great March, it's called, of August 27th, 1968, had 500,000 people out on the streets. It caused panic in the ranks of the government. It was no longer just the young people, quote, causing chaos, unquote. Important sectors of the oppressed took up the cause of the youth in defense of democratic liberties and against the authoritarianism of the government. The day after the great demonstration, two battalions, can you imagine that? Two battalions of army infantry, 12 armored cars of the presidential guards, and four fire trucks evicted an isolated group of young people in the Zocalo, Mexico City's main square. And they had been doing a sit-in. Workers' unions are getting more involved. I don't have time to get into that, really. It's an extremely important point and made the government extremely nervous. Because the government would try to use the bought-off sections of the labor movement against this, but it didn't work. In fact, thousands of public sectors were forced to attend, but they kept shouting, "We did not come, they brought us, we are sheep," etc.
Are you serious?
That's pretty, I like the honesty there. Backing for the students multiplied. Doctors, oil workers organized the strikes. Independent Campesino Union, Revolutionary Teachers Movement, etc. This is the part I didn't really have time to get into. But it's from all over the country, and there was even international solidarity. Because, again, you had May 68, it already happened, and so on. And
And rail workers, electricians,
yep,
parents, people.
Yep. Now, in September...
Merchants, okay, yep. Etc.
Now, on September 1st, the president spoke, and, following the script of, quote, communist plots, unquote, against Mexico, Ordaz, the PRI president, said that it was evident that in recent disturbances, non-student groups had intervened with the intention of sowing disorder, confusion, and bitterness, and preventing attention being paid to the solution of the problems in order to discredit Mexico. The implied objective, of course, was to cause the Olympic Games to flop. However, that lying speech only fueled the outrage of the governments at the governments in transigence when it came to public dialogue. Sort of like Macron recently in France waited weeks before he came out to speak and give concessions on a movement he said he would never give concessions to. 13 September 1968, 300,000 young people paraded silently, the famous March of Silence, peacefully defying the government. Their weapons were their ideas, their pamphlets, their murals painted on the walls and buses. The march was a setback for Ordaz and the forces behind him, because they're trying to scare everybody. And the government strategy, but the government strategy was already decided. 5 days later, with the poems of Leon Felipe rumbling through the loudspeakers, Ciudad Universitaria, 10,000 army personnel were sent in to take that university over, and they arrested 600 students, professors, and officials. The objective, was to dismantle the movement and put an end to the leadership of the youth uprising. So the massacre that some people have heard about. After the capture of CU, a new wave of clashes broke out between the students and the Granaderos, the riot police. The youth made fun of the police siege with lightning rallies. They painted the university and the city with graffiti. And in order to continue functioning, the leadership of the movement moved around the units of the Polytechnic Institute and in the zone of Tlatelolco, where the students staged their first confrontation with army units on September 21st. So, on the morning of October 2nd, state security agents arrived in Tlatelolco. This is the word we've been having trouble pronouncing, without raising too many suspicions because, there'd been a lot of repression, but they proceeded to cut the telephone lines and lights in the area. Snipers of the government, of the army, were located in strategic places of different buildings in the vicinity of the square. Government elements with gloves and white handkerchiefs on their right hands, identification, infiltrated the crowd, key locations in some buildings, within some buildings. The square was surrounded by tanks and military units. Now, that was something very common in those days, but the government turned the place into a deadly trap with only one exit. At 6 in the afternoon, this is again on October 2nd, when 10,000 people were in the Plaza of the Three Cultures listening to this to a rally, a flare was thrown from a helicopter, and this is apparently like as in Vietnam, giving a signal. Snipers and station troops began firing into the crowd. Some soldiers pointed to the crowd. Others who did the sort of rank and file did not know the operation tried to protect it, but between the confusion, the direct fire, and crossfire, the number of young people killed remains unknown.
It's
kind of
like what happened
unknown.
In Venezuela in 2002, remember?
Yeah.
During the coup, coup attempt.
Later, independent reports indicated that the fatalities totaled around 400, while the official media spoke of only 30, all young people between the ages of 18 to 20. The investigations indicate the immense majority of the corpses were taken from the plaza and thrown into the Gulf of Mexico from helicopters, a sinister precedent of the extermination methods used by Operation Condor in Chile and Argentina. This is a CIA thing. The repression was completed with more than 1,000 detainees and thousands of wounded. It's thousands of wounded. Wow. On October 11th, 12th, sorry, the Olympic Games were inaugurated within 10 days after the protests. Then it goes into talking about the criminal history of the Mexican state is not limited to the regime of Diaz Ordaz and the PRI. It goes through other repressive regimes. The defense of Mexican capitalism against the movement in 1968 required a cruel plan, perfectly prepared. The army with tanks and artillery to face any eventuality. The Olympic battalion created for the security of the Olympics, firing from the windows of the buildings. The presidential general staff and the presidential security team dressed in civilian clothes with a white handkerchief in their hands, fully aware of what was going to happen at that rally on 2 October. The rest of the police military apparatus were simply left to act amid the confusion and under the impact of government propaganda, which characterized the movement as a communist threat. So then it gets into the end, the effects of 68. Like in France, this thing, although they're two different things.
Two different ways.
Very different. The France movement, much, much bigger.
Was there a massacre in France at that time?
There was repression, but massacre, let me think. I'm unclear on that. I have to double check that. I believe there were deaths. There was certainly tons of police repression. But what I'm trying to say that was different was the size of the movements, but even so, they both had this huge effect on those societies to this day. Despite the impact of the massacre and after the truce imposed by the Olympics, the strike lasted for 2 more months, demanding the unconditional release of the political prisoners, the return of the schools that were still being taken by the army. And there's been recent, like, repression on UNAM, by the way, so this is nothing. Unfortunately, this is still continuing, the repression. But the student movement had reached its limit. At that juncture, it had two possible paths to follow: to promote a broader revolutionary movement, which implied a true rebellion of the workers against the straitjacket of the trade union structures co-opted by the government at that time, or return to classes. No organization on the left had the capacity or political orientation to follow the first path. The tiredness, the fear, the lack of perspective imposed themselves. We had to change the forms of struggle, and we did not find them, said Paco Ignacio Taibo II, who was involved in 68. On 4 December, the strike was lifted, and the CNH disbanded. Many activists went in search of other alternatives to continue to fight, including the dead end of the so-called urban guerrillism. Others went to nurture neighborhood organizations, democratic and combative unions, etc. After the great massacre, the legitimacy of the army before the people was shattered. Although in return, it obtained all kinds of privileges and corruption. The PRR was very weakened. Never again could they speak as representatives of the 1910 revolution, and the apparent stability achieved in the period of stabilizing development completely vanished. And so this article doesn't go into what's happened recently in Mexico, which maybe we should finish this on real quickly. There was a left populist politician named AMLO, is his short name for short. We did talk about this in the previous show. I don't remember much about that, though, unfortunately. So you've been looking at this recently. Why don't you talk about it?
Yeah, so in his inauguration, he first got it opened. It's kind of like Los Pinos, which is basically the White House of the, you know, of Mexico, equivalent to. Nobody there would go into that place other if you were only in the government. But he opened up on his inauguration and said, I will not live here. I will live in my own humble home, my hammock, sleep in my hammock. And he also claimed that he will, and under his administration, start going for a committee that will investigate the 43, missing students.
Yep.
you can see the reactions of the guys that are probably involved within the government there. Their faces, like, got slapped, you know, like that look in their face.
Yep.
And he's been doing a lot of stuff with the campesinos and where he's from. So I've heard a lot of good things that's happening. Already the minimum wage is going up. Oh yeah, also the he wants, from what my uncle was telling me, a lot of officials over there, let's say kind of like a Shamwat did, you know, where he
Shamwat,
where you get $120,000 and she only receives $70,000 and the rest goes into, you know.
Actually, she only gets $40,000 about.
Or 40. I'm just giving an example of like these outrageous, of these politicians.
So he takes
who
less? He takes less?
Ablo? He takes less, yes. Okay. Half of what, what a working person. Exact. Same program that we ran.
Whenever Socialist Alternative or anyone from the CWI, Community for Workers International, runs for political office, they run on the program of taking only a worker's wage. If they're elected, that means the average worker's wage in their area that they're elected in. And Shama Sawant, two-time elected and re-elected socialist in the Seattle City Council, has done that, ran on that for two terms, and has fulfilled that promise. Of course, the corporate media ignores that. But that's, and the rest is donated to different, progressive and social organizations.
And the corporate media here, except maybe RT Today, exception of RT Today, which is Russia Today, America, talked about that. these politicians are overpaid. They need to, you know what I mean? This whole reduction of how much do you really need, you know, to get by?
Right.
How many yachts, how many mansions?
Yeah.
And,
well, here in Massachusetts, Sir Charles Baker just increased, got through some sort of thing. How he does this as a Republican in Democratic-controlled, vastly, easily dominated Democratic Party legislature in Massachusetts should make one think, but often doesn't. He just got all his cronies 6% raises, and they're already making like over 100,000 or something like that. So yeah, they did really well. I just got a raise at work, by the way. It works out to about 1.5%. Crap. Total crap.
A penny percent?
I need so much more. 1.5%, about 70 cents an hour, something like that. And that's, I believe, gross. I'd have to check the net increase. It's just crap. It's just crap. I need so much more than that. I got my final check of the year. Do you know what the difference was between gross pay and net pay?
Do you get paid weekly or bi-weekly?
Every 2 weeks. But the difference between, yeah, that hurts too. The difference between gross pay and net pay for me was $19,000, almost $20,000.
That you lost.
Gross pay is what they say you make. Net pay is what you actually take home and you can cash in your check. Mm-hmm. You know. So where does all that money go to? Unfair taxes on working people, me, including me. And the stupidness of not having national health care in the United States, I've got to pay tons of money out for family health care and dental care every month. So it's the combination of those plus the a little bit for union dues, which I don't mind, even though my union leadership's a sellout. I don't mind paying union dues. So it's all that stuff. And that adds up over the course of the year to almost 20,000 big ones. 20,000 bones, as they used to say. So that sucks. By the way, that was a little editorial digression because I'm so angry about my pathetic raises. I'm in a union. I deserve more. We should have got more. I'm really upset about it. And my family's suffering for it. But, yeah, we got a car. One of my cars is down, man.
We got a used car.
Another digression, excuse me, but a lot of people will be familiar with this stuff. We bought a used car in 2012. Turned out to be a lemon. We didn't know that at the time.
The white one.
Paid too much for it. Yeah, Nissan. I personally hate Nissan. I know other people that like them, quote unquote, as far as like what they bought from them. I despise Nissan. They sold me a used car that has breaks down about four times a year, like in a major way. Not to mention regular maintenance. But I'm talking like major stuff. First was the transmission went. I still had it under warranty. Didn't pay anything for that. The warranty disappeared. It's been stuff. Really, really serious stuff has gone by. To get the past inspection, I spent about $800. We spent about $800 in September. And now the throttle choke, it's got another name, is not functioning. There's a check engine light. And that's going to be anywhere from, I don't know, so far I've been quoted 1,000 plus, an 800 plus as ways to fix that. We can't afford it. We just can't afford it. You can't come up with that much money all at once. We can't do that. Most Americans can't, actually, statistically, or many, many can't. And unless you go deeper in debt. We're already in debt, so we can't like keep piling debt on debt. So that car's sitting in my driveway right now. You know? And this part, by the way, is important because if you don't fix it, supposedly it starts affecting other parts. It's the mixture of gas and air going into the engine.
Yeah.
And it's messed up because of this part failing. So that can affect then other parts, which would be tens of thousands of dollars more. The car isn't worth that much. I mean, we're going to be paying off this loan for two more years at least that we have in this car.
On the car?
Yeah.
You're still paying
so
a loan
on
the car?
So I don't have title to the car. I can't sell it for parts. I can't sell it for anything unless someone's willing to pay off a loan, which they'll never do because it's thousands of dollars. So we're still paying off a loan on the car. The minute this car started to go bad, after when that transmission went, I was like, in my head, I was like, this car's not going to last the period of the loan. You know how horrible that is?
So they just made money off of money.
Yeah, we're going to be paying for a car sitting in our driveway, basically. Then when we get the title, if we ever get it, we might be able to get someone to tow it away and get no money for it, you know? So, and based on our schedules, and my political work is going to really suffer because of this now. So, Or we cough it up, somehow get the money together, which maybe we can do over the course of a couple months, get it fixed, but then there'll be another repair. They're always talking about the struts are damaged or something. That's a huge repair. In other words, there's a point where in a car, as you know, it's not worth it anymore. We reached that point 2 years ago. We needed the car. We still need it, you know? Yeah. Anyway, the point is, going back to what was the point before that? The raises and then
The raises. Oh, no. Well, we'll talk about, okay. Well, these politicians that get into office, how much they're making. Yeah.
They're making big money. I think Congress gave itself a raise, and the average congressperson, or I think their base salary is $174,000 a year. How about that?
To begin with.
That puts you in the big, 1%. You know, people think that there's a lot of people running around making huge salaries. There aren't. The number of people that make over $100,000, if you know somebody that does this, you got to put it in perspective. I don't care if you personally know them, and there might be a cluster of them in some rich neighborhood, but that's statistically pretty rare. Look it up. That is pretty darn rare in the United States to make that much money, or anywhere in the world, you know? It's weird. You live in a place like, you live around Boston, you see so many rich people running around. You begin to think there's a lot of rich people, but there aren't.
If
you open your eyes and you go around, you find a lot of poor people, a lot of working class people. That's a great point you just made, Diego, and that's a good segue into...
And then it's that bourgeoisie-ness of the culture of I need to go to the Starbucks, and you know, I hate that. I hate the Starbucks people.
We're going
to
get into that.
They held that cup like it's like, this is the iconic cup. Yep. And I'm going to walk with this cup because it says that I am somebody.
Yeah.
I bought Starbucks this morning. You know, who cares?
I spent $4 on coffee, man. I don't do that. In fact, I was saying the other day that when my New Year resolution is to not eat one time a lunch that I have prepared myself. And we've talked about on the show before, like these personal survival strategies are so depressing and stupid that Americans think they can do well by cutting back and cutting back and cutting back, and all of a sudden you get like a big medical bill or something, and that's all wiped out. So, but I'm part of that too. I'm part of that foolishness. So I've been trying to bring my lunch, but it's really hard to find the time to make it and bring it and all that, especially doing political work. So now my New Year's resolution is to, if I don't bring my lunch, I starve. I'm not going to eat out for lunch, even though I'm only spending, those Indian buffets and stuff, 10, 11, 12 bucks.
Yeah, but that adds up, man.
Can't
do that every day.
It adds up. You can't do that every day. Also, I don't do it every day, but I don't want to do it. I want to do it 0 days.
But that's bad, too. You know, not eating is actually as worse as eating. You know, people say there's obesity. There's people that are obese because they don't eat a certain thing or a certain time.
I know. Oh, yeah. I'm not defending it.
When you go to France, you need those two-hour lunches. You know what I mean?
They don't get that anymore, but they used to, yeah.
You know what I mean.
No, I know what you mean. I know. I'm not defending what I'm doing. I'm just saying I'm desperate, you know, like a lot of other people, to save money, and that's going to be one stupid way of doing it. I don't know. I just because that raise thing is just killing me. I needed a 5-6% raise just to get some breathing room for a while. You know, keep paying down debt. Now I'm not going to have that. Now I'm going to have not enough money to live on. Like now, living paycheck to paycheck. Like now, so like everyone else, like a lot of other people. That's the whole thing. And that's a good segue to this. But why don't we finish with AMLO? So AMLO's in power. He's promising stuff. Is he doing anything yet?
He already raised minimum wage. He led his example. This is how much I'm making. I'm only taking $70,000 as opposed to $120,000 or whatever.
He's taking but you know, there are populists in Latin America recently that have done the same thing as he did. They refused to live in there was a guy in Uruguay or somewhere. He refused to live in the presidential palace. He lived a very Spartan life, very
poor. He was interviewed in that South of the Border documentary by Oliver Stone.
I like that a lot. I think it's important so they get a taste, if possible, of what it's like to live as workers on that salary. But it still is it's not the answer, you know. It's not going to save them from what we talked about earlier, that either you put up or shut up as far as socialism goes. It's either revolutionary socialism.
Yep.
Where you're organizing, using your position, even if it's president, to organize a revolution, or you're going to try to accommodate the capitalists. So That's what he faces. Why don't we do a whole show on Mexico on now? Do some research, figure out what AMLO's up to.
Yeah.
But is there anything else you want to say before we move on?
No.
About AMLO?
Not really, because I can't. He's just
first year. Yeah, just starting.
I can't really. But yeah, I'll definitely be looking it up and researching and talking to my uncle.
Me too. Yeah, and then what are you?
He's there. You know what I mean?
You could come back and give eyewitness. Is that going to be soon? You're going to go? Or summer?
Not summertime. Yeah. Around August.
If we still have the show in the summer, no guarantees, but if we still have the show in the summer, we'll have the eyewitness report from AMLO's Mexico. That'll be cool.
Yep.
I'll
be in Mexico City, but...
Say la mismo. La mismo. Okay. Same thing. That's Mexico City's Mexico. No, I'm just kidding. It's not. But anyway, a lot of stuff we were just talking about is a good segue into the state of the economy in the U.S. right now. We've had the recent, if you haven't been following the media, huge fluctuations in the stock market over the holiday period, right before the holidays and after Christmas. Well, it was a downturn. Now they bought back some stuff. Overall, I think it's still a downturn. Overall, for the year, I think is a bit of a downturn. I'll double check all those statistics. But I don't want to talk about the stock market too much. It would be good to, but you know, we have limited time, so we pick and choose. I still want to look at the big picture and what they're talking about. Why the stock market is fluctuating is more important than the fact that it is, in the sense that, well, that doesn't make much sense, but what I mean by that is that I want to talk about the underlying causes of that, but also the underlying cause of economic weakness a little bit, and then talk and some of this has been well researched, doesn't start overnight. But basically, you have the trade war with China, right? But a lot of that is economic competition between U.S. corporations and Chinese-based corporations. U.S.-based corporations, Chinese-based corporations. Even if they do business in each other's country, there's still a trade war going on where the U.S. capitalists want to keep an edge on high tech, and China's catching up to that.
And what about the tariffs?
That's where that comes from.
Another one.
The tariffs, they're hoping to destabilize the Chinese economy. By adding tariffs to goods that up until now they got cheaply from China on purpose through exploiting cheap labor in China with the connivance of the Chinese government. By the way, any kind of, if you're thinking as a listener that the Chinese government is communist, you're crazy.
I know.
It's capitalist. It's state capitalist. Basically, there's a strong state sector there, but it's still run by capitalist mechanisms, values. They pump money into the economy from time to time, but so does the U.S. government. You know what I mean? The capitalist government, there's no such thing as capitalism without government. The whole libertarian thing is a big lie. There's never been capitalism without a strong state, because the state is what enforces the ridiculousness of capitalism, of its crises and its shortages and its scarcities and its exploitation of labor and nature.
Look at the zoning
laws, need the state for all that. Yeah. You need to. Yeah. If you didn't have the cops and the military, you wouldn't have private property. It doesn't make any sense.
In Central Square wouldn't happen, you know what I mean?
Right, but even like, go think of it as the way the Native Americans, when they encountered the Europeans, what are you talking about? This is territory, yeah, we kind of use this area, but it's not ours, we don't own it. You know, so why does a capitalist come in and say, I own part of the rainforest in Brazil and I'm not going to cut down for rubber or whatever, for other things.
Paper.
And for farming and so on. The capitalists in the U.S. part of that, of course. What is that about? You know, that's ridiculousness. That's public land. That's land for the people. You can't own that stuff. We have to decide how we're going to use it, you know. But no, the corporation decides, not us. But anyway, where were we going with that? Oh, yeah, so the trade war is basically economic at its base. It's not just, you know, it's the opposite kind of what Trump says. Trump says this will strengthen the U.S. economy, ignoring the fact that, meaning the U.S. capitalists will start producing stuff that's produced in China, ignoring the fact that it was produced in China to begin with based on the cheap labor. If you put up a tariff there, all they got to do is go to Vietnam or somewhere else for the cheap labor, which they're already doing. By the way,
or North Korea,
and the capitalists themselves will say, which is not true, but they'll say it, and I think they mean it, we're not prepared to set up production of this thing that we've outsourced and gotten from overseas for the last 20 years. Now, they could overnight. You could have a booming steel industry in the United States, or a booming toy industry that's mostly that comes from China now, or dish industry or something. You know what I mean? You could have all that overnight. But the capitalist is not a planned economy. It's the anarchy of capitalism, right? It's every greedy dog for itself, you know? And they want to make money. But they do have a political will. There's a contradiction, but it's there. Their political will is to, you know, sort out, either through Trump's heavy-handed tariffs or in other ways, that they're going to stay on top. You know, the vast majority of capitalists in the U.S., especially the tech capitalists, Google and all that, they're going to stay on top. Bezos with Amazon, you know. And that's where a lot of this stuff comes from. But at the same time, they're... the way they kept the economy going since the Great Recession is through pumping money into the economy, printing up money through, they call it quantitative easing, and by putting money into U.S. government bonds and other government things is the wrong, bad word. I hate when I use the word things. Government bonds and other sources of, like, places to hide, not hide, but places to put money when there's not, the banks don't have high interest rates and stuff. And then the government doing those big corporate bailouts, which were huge during the Obama administration, of the banks and all that, that they paid for that with increased deficits, right? So now you have these bubbles being created in the economy where they're producing a lot of stuff based on wanting to have market share, figuring there's a lot of people that have jobs and stuff like that. We're going to produce that stuff. And people really can't buy it back. The same old overproduction, overcapacity, contradiction of capitalism. And this book, Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America, gets into a lot of statistics about that. So, for example, I'm reading it. I'm just going to go from where I've left off reading it a little bit. They're talking about academics. Now, this is a traditionally upper middle class, right? Teachers and stuff. But hold on a second. They're not anymore. Where does she start this argument? It's called hyper-educated and poor, meaning we're told education. Well, I'll just read this quote, basically, about what I'm talking about. Have you heard of this book, by the way? You got it from the library, public library. I got it from Arlington.
No, I haven't, but you showed me, and I'll definitely look into it.
So, anyway, this, I mean, you know a lot of this stuff. We know a lot of stuff, but it's good to get the stats, right? Much political rhetoric these days devoted to the importance of broadening access to college. And there is plenty of evidence that a degree improves financial prospects. But in the post-crash world of today, that's 2007, 2008, Great Recession she's talking about, a good education may not keep you from hovering near the poverty line. The number of people with graduate degrees receiving food assistance or other forms of federal aid nearly tripled between 2007 and 2010. And those with a PhD, this is like about 2% of the population, who received assistance rose from 9,776 to 33,655. Imagine having a PhD, you're like on food stamps. And I work with some PhDs who are suffering through the low raises as I am, by the way.
It's a system, you know? That's,
exactly.
They've got us, they're grinding us down.
Well, you're not taught that. You're taught, oh, college degree, ticket to paradise. I got one. More specifically, at least 28% of the households that used food stamps in 2013 were headed by a person with at least some college education, 28%. This proportion was only 8% in 1980. Now, this is part of the squeeze that affects parents and their children. The hyper-educated poor lurk alongside the women who are victims of pregnancy. Okay, anyway, that would take longer discussion, but there's a really great chapter in here about, that I just read, about a prejudice and actual repression in the workplace in terms of job loss and so on against pregnant women. Why are millennials having less children? Because you try to get pregnant when there's no daycare subsidy available, and you're going to pay your salary and then some in daycare.
Hey, you're in a country without this the maternity leave is like
right.
3 weeks
exactly,
or a month.
But
you're
also,
lucky you get that.
Say you get that. What do you
serious?
Do when it's done? What do you do when it's over?
Mexico's got better maternity
right.
leave. I'm telling you.
Right, the daycare is so expensive, and I experienced that. My wife and I experienced that. Anyway, so adjuncts, these are people that are not full tenured professors, but they teach classes at a college. A survey of 500 adjuncts, for instance, found that 62% of them make less than $20,000 a year from teaching at a college. The pregnancy discrimination described in the last chapter is one way. That's a great chapter, but we're going to have to talk about that next time, maybe. So then she goes into this, she focuses on the story of, because this comes from this, it's part of the publishing of this book is a a thing started by Barbara Ehrenreich about poverty. What's it called? Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Examines the lives of middle-class Americans who can now barely afford to raise children, etc. All right. Anyway. It's not just academics who are highly educated and downright mobile. Other respected professions are losing their luster as well. Employment for recent law school graduates went from 92% in 2007, which I found high. I didn't think it was even that high, to 84.7% in 2012 to 87% in 2016. The average law school student's debt, listen to this, about $140,000 in 2012, a 59% increase over 2004. This is the part we were talking about earlier. Remember I referenced the book earlier?
Mm-hmm.
Making this squeeze worse, because she goes through a lot of jobs with the same problem, architecture, data processing, book publishing, human resources, finance, all of which require or tend to attract workers with master's degrees. They're all making less. Making the squeeze worse, to my mind, was the oft-heard mantra, quote, do what you love. The exhortation to members of the middle class, I would say working class here, but whatever, they should try to make a living pursuing their dreams. Well-meaning mentors and corporations recited this dictum. I myself have heard it often. Those exhorting others to do what you love manage both to look cool and squeeze more labor out of their workers. The advice is meant to correct old ideas that labor should be dutiful and even servile rather than impassioned. But labor is increasingly construed as vital to one's character and sense of meaning and value. But it wasn't always like this. Work in previous centuries was something people did mostly out of economic urgency. And they dreamed of a heaven where they wouldn't have to work, or a land of milk and honey. Aristocrats, capitalists, of course, tended not to work at all, to live off their property. She says property, I would add to that. Anyway, but to bring this to the present, I don't know if I have time to get into this. Maybe we can pick it up next time. But then she says, Americans may well be marinating in an atmosphere of cruel optimism, as the scholar Lauren Berlant wrote in her book of the same name, an atmosphere that exists when something you desire is actually an obstacle to your flourishing. Among the impossible objectives embodied by the directive, do what you love, is the fantasy of the good life. Individual security and promise have frayed. Upward mobility, job security, political and social equality, and lively, durable intimacy are all frayed, and yet we all believe we can have it all, even when America no longer aids us in having our lives and careers add up to something. For example, I don't have time to get into it, but that's
exactly
like you never
the
get to retire.
That I had when I went to college, that small business place, where it was like, you're the next generation.
Yeah.
You are the next da da da. And I said, wait a minute, you're acting like you're an upward. This is 98. This is going to continue.
Oh, that was the height of that
when
stuff.
When history proves that it's up and down.
Yep.
And you're telling us that we can do whatever we want to do, and that's it, you know.
Yeah.
That's my first criticism of the educational system in this country. To put that in young people's head, you can be whatever you want to be. What is that?
Yep.
Number one.
I agree. It's really...
I would be realist. That's why I would literally be fired the first week. Because dare you tell the... I'm being real about this, the economic.
Well, you hear it all the time. Follow your passion, And capitalism doesn't pay for your passion. Capitalism pays for what it wants. And it doesn't even pay if it can get away with it. So you have... And she talks about this a little bit, but, weaker labor movement, no left movement. Capitalism is going to get away with murder, paying very little.
Soon they're going to get to a point where you're just not going to pay. We'll give you a little this, little that to get by, but that's it. Basically, slavery.
Yep. And that of course, the system, capitalism can't exist on a slavery. They depend on 80% of consumer spending, 80% of GDP is consumer spending. If you're a slave, you got no consumer spending, right? This you're going to like this. The hyper-educated poor are as hidden to the country as at large as Bolin, but B-O-L-I-N, this is a person who's got a PhD and is struggling, is at the college where she taught. Quote, nobody knows or cares that I have a PhD living in the trailer park. Yeah, that's true. That's darn true. Every American thinks they're a temporarily embarrassed millionaire. I am no exception. That's just a librarian from Minnesota, web developer. Who says her friends don't have any clue how broke she really is. She goes, I'm like every American who thinks they're a temporarily embarrassed millionaire. I am no exception. That's based on that famous quote by Steinbeck. You've heard that, right?
Mm.
Oh, yeah, he had a famous quote. I don't think it was in Grapes of Wrath. I think it was somewhere else. I think it was Steinbeck. Could have been somebody else. They said it might have been like some other famous progressive or left socialist writer. But yeah, they said I don't want to screw up the quote, and you can look it up really, really easily on Google, but it's like, the reason we don't have a revolution in America is that every poor American thinks of themselves as a temporary,
poor,
embarrassed, how does it go here, embarrassed millionaire, that we're so brainwashed about the opportunities, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, Horatio Alger myth, whatever you want to call it, the crap, the American dream, you know, you got to be asleep to believe it, as George Carlin said. he keeps getting better and better, by the way, death. I keep getting these quotes on Facebook that are better and better by George Carlin about
one
capitalism.
One thing the other day, I had a dream. It's weird. I was thinking about homelessness, and in some reason, I was watching George Carlin, New York jamming back in 91.
Okay.
And that's where he was talking about, he said something to the point of, if there's no money in it as far as like housing, you put money in, oh, everybody, we'll free up the whole street all of a sudden. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Let me see. Almost no time. 4 minutes. Let's see. Maybe we got to stop and throw the Fugees on. Yeah, let's do that. So Squeezed by Alyssa Court. We're going to come back to that in the future. What do you got from the Fugees? What
number track? Six, Fugee Law.
Fugee Law. It's not. Oh, yeah, it is. Okay. All right, cool. So we're going to go out with a track by the Fugees. And thanks for listening to Social Alternative
and
Radio.
Happy New Year's.
Happy New Year,
happy
2019.
New Year's. Keep the struggle up.
Yeah, hopefully that will be the year of World Socialist Revolution, but we're not predicting that. We're just saying hopefully. But there will be a lot happening, obviously. And the best way to understand it and contend with it and to affect it and to be part of it and to engage with it, and to become a socialist, become a revolutionary socialist in the new year. Make that your resolution. Yeah. I will become a revolutionary socialist. I will join Socialist Alternative.
I think the word socialism is not as demonized anymore.
By the polling data, it's definitely not. Nope. So, Fuji La. And yeah, keep up the struggle in the new year. We'll be back in a couple weeks. And
power to the workers and the people.
And speaking of that, we were talking about earlier, the watch out for the LA teachers going on strike, if that hasn't started already. The steel workers in this area, under a harsh regime of National Grid, they may be coming to a settlement. That might have even happened already yesterday. I'm not sure. There's the women's movement march coming up. You know, if they follow through on it, there's one every year now since Trumpo got elected. That's supposed to be January 19th. Be a lot of members of Social Alternative out there. We'll be out there. Stuff's going to start picking up. And we hope our listeners are going to be a part of that in the socialist way, in the progressive way, very progressive way. And thanks for listening. Here's the Fugees.
We used to be number 10, now we permanent in one. In the battle, lost my finger. Mike became my arm, pistol nozzle, it's nasal. Blood becomes lukewarm, tell them, oh, mom, be easy now, squeeze this armor. Test why cleft, see that flesh get scorned. Beat so bad, make me feel like you ain't wanting to be born, John.
Gucci's and Lucci by me in my Mitsubishi, eating sushi, bumping Fuji's.